his first marriage were grown, and Sonia's relationship with her daughter, London, was so stormy, she said she'd never want another. There were no grandchildren in the family, yet, thank God, said Sonia. As I said, I was born late, into the aging tier of the family, and to parents who would often be mistaken for my grandparents. There was that added weight of being a surprise to my mother and father, and the surging hopes that implied. It was all on me, the bad and the good. But one of the chief goods, one I cherished, was the proximity I was allowed to Sonia's breasts. I could press against her breasts for as long as she hugged me. I was careful never to push my luck, though my hands itched, full, delicate, resolute, and round. Sonia's were breasts to break your heart over. She carried them high in her pastel scoop neck t-shirts. Her waist was still trim and her hips flared softly in tight stonewashed jeans. Sonia massaged her skin with baby oil, but all her life she had harshly tanned and her cute Swedish nose was scarred by sunburn. She was a horse lover, and she and Whitey kept a mean old paint, a fancy quarter horse, Arabian mix, a roan Appaloosa with one ghost eye named Spook, and a pony. So along with the whiskey and perfume and smoke, she often exuded faint undertones of hay, dust, and the fragrance of horse, which once you smell it, you always miss it. Humans were meant to live with the horse. She and Whitey also had three dogs, all female, ferocious, and named in some way after Janis Joplin. Our dog had died 2 months ago, and we hadn't got a new one yet. I opened my backpack, and Sonia put in the milk and other things I'd picked out. She pushed back my $5 and gazed at me from under her delicate, pale brown, plucked eyebrows. Tears fluttered her eyes. Shit, she said. Let me at the guy. I'll waste him. I did not know what to say. Sonia's breast made most thoughts leave my head. How's your mom doing? She said, shaking her head, swiping at her cheeks. I tried to focus now. My mother was not fine, as so I could not answer fine. Nor could I tell Sonia that half an hour ago I feared my mother was dead, and I had rushed upon her and got hit by her for the first time in my life. Sonia lit a cigarette, offered me a piece of black jack gum. Not good, I said, jumpy. Sonia nodded. We'll bring Pearl. Pearl was a rangy, long-legged mutt with a bull terrier's broad head and vice-like jaws. She had Doberman markings, a shepherd's heavy coat, and some wolf in her. Pearl didn't bark much, but when she did, she became very worked up. She paced and snapped the air whenever someone violated her invisible territorial boundaries. Pearl was not a companion dog, and I wasn't sure I wanted her, but my father did. She's too old to teach, to fetch and stuff, I complained to him when he got home that night. We were sitting downstairs eating heated-up casserole brought over again by Clements. My father had made his usual pot of weak coffee, and he was drinking it like water. My mother was in the bedroom, not hungry. My father put down his fork. From the way he did it, he was a man who liked his food, and to stop eating was usually a relinquishment. Though these days he wasn't eating much, I thought he was angry. But although his gestures of recent were abrupt, and he often clenched his fists, he did not raise his voice. He spoke very quietly, reasonably, telling me why we needed Pearl. Joe, we need a protection dog. There is a man we suspect, but he has cleared out, which means he could be anywhere, or he might not have done it. But the real attacker could still be in the area. I asked what I thought was a police TV question. What evidence do you have that this one guy did it? My father considered not answering, I could tell, but he finally did. He had trouble saying some of the words. The perpetrator or the suspect, the attacker, dropped a book of matches. The matches were from the golf course. They give them out at the desk. So they're starting with the golfers, I said. This meant the attacker could be Indian or white. That golf course fascinated everyone. It was a kind of fad. Golf was for rich people, supposedly, but here we had a course of scraggly grass and natural water pits. With a special introductory rate, people passed their clubs around and everybody seemed to have tried it, except my dad. Yes, the golf course. Why'd he drop the matches? My father rubbed a hand across his eyes and again had trouble speaking. He wanted to, tried to. He was having trouble lighting a match.
A book match?
Yes.
Oh. Did he get it lit?
No. The match was wet. So then what happened? Suddenly my eyes began to water and I bent over my plate. My father picked his fork back up. He quickly shoveled Clements's well-known macaroni and tomato sauce hamburger concoction into his mouth. He saw that I had stopped eating and was waiting, and he sat back. He drained another cup of coffee from his favorite heavy white china diner mug. He put a napkin to his lips, shut his eyes, opened them, and looked at me directly. All right, Joe, you're asking a lot of questions. You're developing an order to things in your mind. You're thinking this out.
So am I, Joe.
The perpetrator couldn't light the match. He went to look for another book of matches, some way of lighting a fire. While he was gone, your mother managed to escape.
How?
For the first time since we pulled out those trees the Sunday before, my father smiled. Or it was some version of a smile, I should say. There was no amusement in it. Later on, if I had to classify that smile, I would say it was a smile like Musham's. A smile of remembrance of lost times. Joe, do you remember how I used to get so exasperated when your mother locked herself out of her car? She had, still has, the habit of leaving the car keys on the dashboard. After she parks, she always gathers her papers or groceries off the passenger seat. Then she puts her keys on the dash, gets out, and locks the car. She forgets that she left her keys in the car until she needs to go home. Then she rummages through her purse and can't find her keys. Oh, no, she says, not again. She goes out, sees her car keys are on the dashboard, locked inside, and then calls me. Remember? Yeah. I almost smiled, too, as he described what had been her habit. The whole rigmarole we went through. Yeah, Dad, she calls you. You use a mild swear word. Then you get the extra set of keys and take a long walk over to the tribal offices.
Mild swear word. Where'd you get that?
Damn, I don't know. He smiled again, put his hand out, and nicked at my cheek with his knuckle. I never really minded, he said, but one day it occurred to me that your mom would be really stuck if I wasn't home. We don't go many places. Our schedule is pretty boring. But if I wasn't home, or you weren't, to bike her keys over, that's never happened.
But see, you might have been outside, not heard the telephone, I thought. What if she really gets stuck somewhere?
And thinking this, about 2 months ago, I glued a magnet onto the back of one of those little metal boxes Whitey sells mints in. I saw someone else had a key holder like it. I put a key in the box and stuck it outside the car's frame just over the left rear tire. That's how she escaped.
What?
I said, how? She managed to reach under the car. She got the car key. He came at her. She locked herself in the car. Then she started the car and drove away. I took a deep breath. I couldn't help a sense of her fear from slashing through me, and it made me weak. My father started eating again, and this time he was clearly going to finish his meal. The subject of what had happened to my mother was closed. I went back to the dog.
Pearl bites, I said.
Good, said my father.
He's still after her, then.
We don't know, said my father. Anybody could have picked up those matches, Indian, white. Anybody could have dropped them, but probably it was someone from around here.
You can't tell if a person is an Indian from a set of fingerprints. You can't tell from a name. You can't even tell from a local police report. You can't tell from a picture, from a mugshot, from a phone number. From the government's point of view, the only way you can tell an Indian is to look at that person's history. There must be ancestors from way back who signed some documents or recorded as Indians by the U.S. government, someone identified as a member of a tribe. And then after that, you have to look at that person's blood quantum, how much Indian blood they've got that belongs to one tribe. In most cases, the government will call the person an Indian if their blood is one quarter. It usually has to be from one tribe. But that tribe has also got to be federally recognized. In other words, being an Indian is in some ways a tangle of red tape. On the other hand, Indians know other Indians without the need for a federal pedigree, and this knowledge, like love, sex, or not having a baby, has nothing to do with government. It took me another day to find out that it was already going around that there were suspects. Basically, anyone who acted strange or had not been seen or had been seen walking out of his back door with loaded black garbage bags. I found out by going over to my aunt and uncle's house to pick up a pie on Saturday afternoon. My mother had told my father that she thought she had better get up, bathe, get dressed. She was still on pain pills, but Dr. Egg had told her that bed rest wouldn't help. She needed mild activity. Dad had announced that he was cooking dinner from a recipe, but he could not manage dessert, thus the pie. Uncle Whitey was sitting at the table with a glass of iced tea. Mushum sat across from him, hunched and frail, wearing ivory-colored long underwear and a plaid robe over the long johns. He refused to dress in street clothes on Saturday because he needed a day of comfort. He claimed to get ready for Sunday when Clements made him wear suit pants, a pressed white shirt, and sometimes a tie. He too had a glass of iced tea, but he was glaring at it. Bunny piss, he griped. That's right, Daddy, said Clements. It's an old man's drink. It's good for you. Ah, swamp tea, said Uncle Whitey, swirling the glass appreciatively. Good for everything that ails you, Daddy. Cures old age, said Mushum. Takes the years off. All but, said Whitey, who knew he could have a beer as soon as he got home and quit pretend drinking with Mushum, who was lonely for the old days when Clements poured smooth whiskey. She'd become convinced that it was harming him and was always trying to cut him off. This goes down hard, my daughter, he said to Clements. Cleans out your liver good, though, said Whitey. Here, Clements, pour a little swamp tea for Joe. Clements poured me a glass of iced tea and went to answer the phone. People were calling her constantly for news, gossip, really, about her sister. Maybe the pervert really is an Indian, said Uncle Whitey. He was carrying an Indian suitcase. What Indian suitcase, I said. The plastic garbage bags. I leaned forward, so he left. But from where? Who is he? What's his name? Clements came back in and flared her eyes at him. Ah, oui, said Uncle Whitey. Guess I'm not supposed to talk. Or have even a little glass of whiskey. Or piss in the sink, as I will do, until she no longer pours swamp tea. A man's kidneys overflow, said Mushum. You piss in the sink? I asked.
When given tea, always. Clements went into the kitchen, came out with a bottle of whiskey and three stacked shot glasses. She arranged them on the table and poured two a quarter full. She poured the third half full and tossed it back. I was astounded. I had never seen my aunt toss back a whiskey like a man. She held her drained glass delicately for a moment, regarding us, then put the glass down with a short smack and walked outside. "What was that?" Uncle Whitey asked. "That was my daughter, pushed too far," said Moosham. "I pity Edward when he returns. The whiskey will have set by then." "Sometimes whiskey sets Sonya, too," Uncle Whitey said. "But I have tricks." "What kind of tricks?" said Moosham. "Old Indian tricks. Teach them to Edward, eh? He is losing ground." The pie began to scent the air with a sweet amber fragrance. I hope my aunt hadn't got so angry she forgot the pie. "The golf course. Is that where it happened?" I looked straight at Whitey, but he dropped his eyes and drank. "No, it didn't happen there." "Where did it?" Whitey raised his sad and permanently bloodshot eyes. He wasn't going to tell me. I couldn't hold his gaze. Moosham's grip, so unsteady on the tea glass that he'd slopped it on the table, tightened now. He lifted the shot and took a neat sip. His eyes shone. He had not taken in our exchange. His brain was still fixed on women. "Ah, my son, tell Oops and me of your beautiful wife, Red Sonya. Paint the picture. What does she do at present?" Whitey shifted his eyes off me. When he grinned, the devil's gap between his front teeth showed. Red Sonya was my aunt's exotic dance persona not so long ago. She'd worn revealing barbarian armor, which was bits of studded plastic. Tattered scarves flowed from her hips. The transparent material looked to have been chewed and clawed by desperate men or pet wolves. Zack had found the picture in a Minneapolis publication and made me a gift of it. I kept it deep in my closet, in a special folder I had made that said, "Homework." "These days, Sonya works behind the cash register," my uncle said now, the whiskey adding its soft glow. "She is always adding numbers. Today she is figuring out exactly what we must reorder for the next week." Moosham closed his eyes, held the whiskey at the back of his tongue, and nodded, conjuring her up, bent over the accounts. I could see her suddenly, too, breasts riding like clouds over the long columns of neat little figures. "And what will she do?" asked Moosham dreamily. "When she has the sums and figures for the day. When she is finished." "She will leave the desk and go outside with a bucket of water and long-handled squeegee. She cleans the glass every week." Moosham wasn't wearing his flashy dentures, and his collapsed smile spread. I closed my eyes and saw the pink sponge side of the squeegee drip its window solution suds down the plate glass. Sonya stretched up on her tiptoes. Cappy's big brother, Randall, said girls look so good stretching up on their tiptoes that he liked to sit watching down the rows in the school library. Randall used to put all the good books on the top shelves. Moosham sighed. I saw Sonya pressing the rubber blade hard against the glass, drawing the dust and the smudges down with the liquid and leaving a sparkling clarity. Clements came back in, breaking my thoughts, and I heard the creak of the oven door. Then the slide of the rack as she removed two pies from the oven. I heard her set the pies out to cool. The oven door clanged, and the screen door whined open and clapped shut. In a moment, the faint crispness of a burning cigarette wafted through the screen. I'd never known my aunt to smoke before. but she had started since the hospital. The scent of Clements's newly taken up smoking sobered both of the men. They turned to me, and Uncle Whitey's face was grave as he asked how my mother was. "She's coming out of her room tonight," I told Whitey. "I'm supposed to take a pie home. My dad is cooking." Mushum stared at me, an edge of harsh brilliance in his gaze, and I knew he had been told something, at least of what had occurred. "That's good," he said. "Hear me now, Oops. She's got to come out. Don't leave her to sit. Don't let her alone too much." Clear spring shadows spread like water across the road. Down past the quiet slough, engines rumbled up to and away from the liquor store's drive-up window. From yards invisible behind the strands of willow and chokecherry, the short, vibrant cries of women rang, calling their children home. A car slowed next to me, and Doe Lafrenay nodded at the empty passenger seat. Doe had a quiet face, a crooked nose, kind eyes. He had powerful arms and stayed strong through constant hard labor. Besides being the chairman and janitoring, he had built their house from scratch. He and his sons had messed it up from scratch, too. The place was layers of junk on interesting junk now. He drove on when I shook my head and called out that I'd see him later. I was helping out that evening at Randall's sweat lodge. Clements had put the pie in the bottom of a shallow cardboard box. The steam from the warm apples threaded from the slit crust. The evening wasn't cooling off, but I didn't care. I'd sweat to eat that pie. I turned down the driveway and Pearl popped out of the lilacs. She gave one deep-chested bark of recognition, and after sniffing the air about me, she accompanied me. At a space of about 3 feet up to the back door of the house, there she left me and went back to lie underneath her bush. My father let me in. The hot kitchen smelled of some violent experiment. "Perfect timing," he said, and put the pie on the counter. "Let's keep this as a surprise, the pièce de résistance. She'll be down in a minute, Joe. Wash up." While I was in the little toilet off the study, I heard the stairs creak. I stayed in there, washing and drying my hands slowly. I didn't really want to see my mother. It was terrible, but it was true. Even though I understood perfectly why she had struck me, I resented that I had to pretend it hadn't happened or didn't matter. The blow had not left a visible bruise, and my cheekbone was only slightly tender, but I kept touching the place and reviving my sense of injury. When I finished washing, I refolded the towel for perhaps the first time in my life and hung it carefully upon its rail. In our dining cove, my mother was standing behind her chair with her hands nervous on the wooden back. The fan was on, stirring her dress. She was admiring the meal laid out on the plain green cloth. I looked at her and was immediately ashamed of my resentment. Her face was still garishly marked. I busied myself. My father had made a stew. The collision of smells that hit me when I entered the kitchen were the ingredients. Sour turnips and canned tomatoes, beets and corn, scorched garlic, unknown meat, and an onion gone bad. The concoction gave off a penetrating reek. My father beckoned the two of us to sit down. There were potatoes, nearly cooled, way overcooked, disintegrating in an undrained pot. He ceremoniously heaped our shallow bowls. Then we sat looking at the food. We didn't pray. For the first time, I felt the lack of some ritual. I couldn't just start eating. My father sensed this and spoke with great emotion, looking at us both. "Very little is needed to make a happy life," he said. My mother took a sharp breath and frowned. She shrugged away what he'd said, as if it irritated her. I guess she'd heard his Marcus Aurelius quote before. But looking back on it, I also know she was trying to build up her shield, to not feel things. not referred to what had happened. His emotion grabbed at her. With no ceremony, she picked up her spoon and plunged it into the stew. She choked her first gulp down. I sat poised. We both looked at my father. "I added caraway seeds," he said gently. "What do you think?" My mother took a paper napkin from the pile my father had laid in the middle of the table, and she held it to her lips. Deep violet streaks and the yellow of healing contusions still marred her face. The white of her left eye was scarlet, and her eyelid drooped slightly as if it would from then on. For the nerve had been tampered with, and the damage was irreversible. "What do you think?" my father asked once more. My mother and I were silent, staring in shock at what we had tasted. "I think," she said at last, "that I should start cooking again." My father cast his eyes down, put out his hands, the picture of a man who had tried his best. He pouted a little and dug into his bowl with a pretend heartiness that grew labored. He swallowed once, twice. I was aghast at his strength of mind. I filled up on bread. His spoon slowed, my mother and I probably realized at the same time that my father, who had taken care of my grandmother for many years and certainly knew how to cook, had faked his ineptitude. But the stew, with its gagging undertone of rotted onion, was so successfully infernal that it cheered us up, as my mother's decision to cook had done. When I cleared away the awful dinner and the pie was produced, my mother smiled slightly, just an upward movement of her lips. My father divided the pie into three equal pieces and laid a slab of blue bunny vanilla on top of each piece. I got to finish my mother's. She started teasing my father about the stew. "Exactly how old were those turnips?" "Older than Joe. And where did you get that onion?" "That's my little secret." "And the meat, roadkill?" "Oh, God, no. It died in the backyard." I wasn't particularly worried about missing dinner that night, because I knew after Randall's sweat lodge that Cappy and his sidekick, me, would eat top shelf. We were the firekeepers. Cappy's aunts, Suzette and Josie, who had made those boys their pets, always fixed the food. On ceremony nights, they'd leave a feast put up neatly in two big plastic coolers alongside the garage. Farther back, nearly in the woods, the sweat lodge, dome of bent and lashed together saplings covered by army surplus tarps, humidly waited, gathering mosquitoes. Cappy had already made the fire, the rocks, the grandfathers, were superheating in the middle. Our job was to keep that fire going. Hand in the sacred pipes and the medicines. Bring the rocks to the door on long-handled shovels. Close and open the flaps. We'd also throw tobacco into our fire when someone in the lodge yelled for it, to mark some special prayer or request. On crisp nights, it was a good job. We'd sit talking around that fire, staying warm. Sometimes we'd secretly roast a hot dog or marshmallow on a stick, even though the fire was sacred. And one time Randall had caught us. He'd claimed we'd taken the sacredness out of the fire with our hot dogs. Cappy looked at him and said, "How sacred can your fire be if we sucked out its holiness with just our puny wieners?" I couldn't stop laughing. Randall threw up his hands and walked off. It was too hot to roast anything now. Besides, we knew we'd eat hugely at the end. Food was our pay. Besides, sometimes driving Rando's beat-up Olds. It was usually a pleasant enough job. That night, however, instead of cooling off, it grew muggy. There was no breeze. Even before sunset, whining clouds of mosquitoes swarmed us. Their attack made us sit closer to the fire, in order to take advantage of the smoke, which only made us sweat enticingly. They just kept sucking on us through the salty, smoky layers of off. Randall's friends, who all belonged to a powwow drum or danced like Randall, showed up laughing. Two of them were baked, but Randall didn't notice. He was obsessive about setting everything up perfectly. The rack for the pipes, the star quilt blanket smoothed out beside the entrance, the abalone shell for burning sage, the glass jars of powdered medicine, the bucket and dipper. He seemed to have a little measuring stick in his head for lining up these sacred items. It drove Cappy nuts. But other people liked Randall's style, and he had friends from all over Indian country. Just that day, he opened a package from a Pueblo friend, which contained a jar of medicine that was now sitting with the others. He was humming a pipe-loading song and putting his pipe together, concentrating so hard he didn't notice that the back of his neck was covered with gorging mosquitoes. I swiped them off. "Thanks," he said distractedly. "I'm going to pray for your family." "That's cool," I said. Though it made me uncomfortable, I didn't like being prayed for. As I turned away, I felt the prayers creeping up my spine. But that was Randall, too, always ready to make you feel a little uncomfortable with the earnest superiority of all that he was learning from the elders, even your own elders, for your benefit. Mushum had instructed Doe on how to set up this lodge, and Doe had passed it down to Randall. Cappy saw my look. "Don't worry about it, Joe. He prays for me, too, and he gets a lot of girls with his medicine. So he's got to keep in practice." Randall had a stony profile, smooth skin, and a long braided ponytail. Girls, especially white ones, were fascinated with him. A German girl had camped in their yard for a whole month one summer. She was pretty and wore the first earth sandals ever seen on our reservation, so Randall got teased about them. Somebody got a good look at the label, and it was Birkenstock, which became Randall's nickname. The heat grew worse, and we guzzled dippers of the sacred sweat lodge water. I envied the guys going into the lodge because they would get so hot that this outside heat would seem like a cool breeze when they came out. Plus, the fiercer heat from those grandfathers would wilt the mosquitoes. They all went in. Cappy and I brought the rocks to the door with the long-handled shovels. Randall took them off the shovels with a pair of deer antlers and placed them in the center pit. We handed in all of their stuff and closed the flap. They started singing, and we sprayed ourselves again with off. We had finished three rounds and passed in the last of the grandfathers. We'd gone up to the house to refill the water cooler and were coming out, standing on the back deck, when there was an explosion. We didn't even hear anyone yell, "Door!" signaling us to open it. The top of the sweat lodge just billowed up and heaved with guys fighting to get out. They raged and flailed in the tarps. There was muffled howling. Then they popped out any way they could, gasping, yelling, and rolling naked in the grass. The mosquitoes dive-bombed. We ran down with the water cooler. Randall and his buddies made gestures at their squeezed-up faces, and we doused their heads. As soon as they could jump up, each one of them staggered or ran toward the house. Cappy's aunts were driving up just then with extra fry bread for the feast, so they saw eight naked Indians trying to grope their way across the yard. Suzette and Josie just stayed in the car. It took a long while, everyone sitting in the house amid the piles of bachelor junk, for the men to emerge from shock and figure out what happened. "I think it was," said Skippy at last, "that Pueblo medicine. Remember, just before you threw a big handful on the rocks, you thanked your buddy down there. Then you said a longish prayer." "A long, long prayer, Birkenstock. Then you ladled on that water." "Oh," said Randall, "my friend said it was a Pueblo medicine. I was praying for his situation with a Navajo woman. Cappy, go and get that jar." "Don't order me." "Okay, please, younger brother, seeing as we're all butt naked and traumatized, would you go out and get that jar?" Cappy went out. He came back. There was a label on the jar. "Randall," said Cappy. The word medicine has quote marks around it. The jar was filled with a brownish powder that didn't smell very strong to us, not like bear root or weeke or kinnikinick. Randall held the jar out and frowned. He sniffed it like it was a fancy wine taster. At last he licked his fingers, stuck it in the jar, and put his fingers in his mouth. Tears spurted instantly.
Ah! Ah!
He stuck his tongue out. Hot pepper, said the others. Special Pueblo hot pepper. They watched Randall dance around the room. Man, look at his feet fly. We should give him Pueblo medicine next powwow. For sure, man. They took long drinks of water. Randall was at the sink with his tongue sticking out under the water tap. Randall placed that medicine down on the rocks, said Skippy.
But when he threw down four big ladles of water, then...
Man, it vaporized into our eyes and we were breathing that shit in. It burnt like hell. How could Randall have done that to us, man? They all looked at Randall with his tongue under the faucet. I hope he puts more clothes on, finally, said Chiboy Snow. We remembered the ants when we heard them pull out of the driveway. We looked out. They left behind two bags of fresh fry bread. The grease was darkening the paper sacks in delicate patches. If you bring our clothes in, Skippy said to us, and hand in the feast, I'll pay yous. How much, said Cappy. Two each. Cappy looked at me. I shrugged. We hauled their stuff in, and as we were all eating, Randall came in and sat next to me. His face was rugged and raw like all the other guys. His eyes were swollen red. Randall had most of his college education, and sometimes he talked like he was addressing me as a social service case, and other times he treated me like his little brother. This was one of those close, familial Randall times. His friends were already laughing and eating. They'd forgotten to be mad at Randall now, and everything was funny. Joey said, I saw something in there. I filled my mouth with taco meat. I saw something, he went on. And he sounded genuinely troubled. It was before the hot pepper blew things up that I saw it. I was praying for your family and my family, and all of a sudden, I saw a man bending over you, like a police maybe, looking down at you, and his face was white and his eyes deep down in his face. He was surrounded by a silver glow. His lips moved and he was talking, but I could not hear what he said. We sat there quietly. I stopped eating. What should I do about it, Randall? I asked in a low voice. We'll both put down tobacco, he said, and maybe you should talk to Mushim. It had a bad feeling, Joe. My mother cooked all the next week and even made it outside, where she sat on a frayed lawn chair scratching Pearl's neck. Staring into the choked cherry bushes that marked the boundaries of the backyard. My father spent as much time home as possible, but he was still called to finish out some of his responsibilities. He was also meeting daily with the tribal police and talking to the federal agent who was assigned to the case. One day he traveled to Bismarck and back to talk with the U.S. attorney, Gabir Olson, an old friend. The problem with most Indian rape cases was that even after there was an indictment, the U.S. attorney often declined to take the case to trial for one reason or another, usually a raft of bigger cases. My father wanted to make sure that didn't happen. So the days went by in that false interlude. On Friday morning, my father reminded me that he would need my help. I often earned a few dollars by biking to my father's office after school and putting the court to bed for the weekend. I swept out his small office, spray-wiped the glass top of his wooden desk. I straightened and dusted the diplomas on his wall, University of North Dakota, University of Minnesota Law School, and the plaques recognizing his service in law organizations. He had a list of places he was admitted to practice that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I was proud of that. Next door, in his closet-turned chambers, I did a sweep-out. President Reagan, ruddy cheeks and muddled eyes, B-movie teeth, grinned off the wall in his government-issue portrait. Reagan was so dense about Indians, he thought we lived on preserves. It was a print of our tribal seal on one of the great seal of North Dakota. My father had framed an antiquified copy of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, plus the Bill of Rights. Back in his office, I shook out his brown wool rug. I put away and straightened up his books, which included all the later editions of the old Cohen Handbook at home. There was the 1958 edition issued during the era when Congress was intent on terminating Indian tribes. It was always left on the shelf, its disuse a mute rebuke to the editors. There were the 1971 facsimile edition and the 1982 edition, big, heavy, well-worn. Next to those books, there was a compact copy of our own tribal code. I also helped my father file whatever his secretary, Opitchi Wold, hadn't put away. Opitchi, whose name meant Robin, was a dour little skinny woman with pin-sharp eyes. She functioned as my father's set of reservation eyes and ears. Every judge needs a scout out there. Opitchi gathered tidbits, call it gossip, but what she knew often informed my father's decisions. She knew who could be released on recognizance, who'd run. She knew who was dealing, who was only using, who was driving without a license, who was abusive, reformed, drinking, dangerous, or safe with their own children. She was invaluable, though her filing system was opaque. We kept all papers next door in a larger room walled with tan metal filing cabinets. A few files were always left on top of the cabinets because my father had expressed an interest in reading them over, or was adding notes. That day I noticed large stacks were left out, chestnut brown cardboard files with the labels neatly typed and fixed on by Opitchi. Most were notes on cases, summaries, and thoughts. Drafts were preceded a final published judgment. I asked if we were going to file them, thinking they were too many to finish before supper time. "We're taking them home," said my father. This was a thing he did not do. His study at home was his retreat from all that went on in tribal court. He was proud of leaving the week's turmoil where it belonged. But today we loaded the files into the back seat. We put my bike in the trunk and drove home. "I'll take those files in myself after dinner," he said on the way, so I knew he did not want my mother to see him bring those files into the house. After the car was parked, we took my bike out and I wheeled it around back. My father entered before me. Walking through the kitchen door, I heard a splintering crash and then a keen, low, anguished cry. My mother was backed up to the sink, trembling, breathing heavily. My father was standing a few feet before her with his hands out, vainly groping in air the shape of her, as if to hold her without holding her. Between them on the floor lay a smashed and oozing casserole. I looked at my parents and understood exactly what had happened. My father had come in. Surely Mom had heard the car, and hadn't Pearl barked? His footsteps, too, were heavy. He always made noise and was, as I have mentioned, a somewhat clumsy man. I noticed that in the last week he also shouted something silly when returning, like, "I'm home." But maybe he'd forgotten. Maybe he'd been too quiet this time. Maybe he'd gone into the kitchen just as he always used to, and then he'd put his arms around my mother as she stood with her back turned. In our old life, she would have kept working at the stove or sink while he peered over her shoulder and talked to her. They'd stand there together in a little tableau of homecoming. Eventually, he'd call me in to help him set the table. He'd change his clothes quickly while she and I put the finishing touches on the meal, and then we would sit down together. We were not churchgoers. This was our ritual. Our breaking bread, our communion. And it all began with the trusting moment where my father walked up behind my mother and she smiled at his approach without turning. But now they stood staring at each other helplessly over the broken dish. It was the kind of moment I see now that could have gone several ways. She could have laughed. She could have cried. She could have reached for him, or he could have got down on his knees and pretended to have the heart attack that later killed him. She would have been jolted from her shock, helped him. We'd have cleared up the mess, made sandwiches for ourselves, and things would have gone on. If we'd sat down together that night, I do believe things would have gone on. But now my mother flushed darkly, and an almost imperceptible shudder coursed over her. She took a gasping breath and put her hand to her wounded face. Then she stepped over the mess on the floor and walked carefully away. I wanted her to shout, cry out, throw something. Anything would have been better than the frozen suspension of feeling in which she mounted the stairs. She was wearing a plain blue dress that night, no stockings, a pair of black Minnetonka moccasins. As she walked up each riser, she looked straight ahead, and her hand was firm on the banister. Her steps were soundless. She seemed to float. My father and I had followed her to the doorway, and I think as we watched her, we both had the sense that she was ascending to a place of utter loneliness from which she might never be retrieved. We stood together even after the bedroom door clicked shut. At last we turned, and without a word, we went back into the kitchen and scraped up the casserole and broken dish. Together we brought the mess outside to the garbage. My father paused after he closed the bin. He bowed his head, and at that moment I was first aware that he exuded a desolation that would grip him with increasing force. When he remained there motionless, I truly became frightened. I put my hand urgently on his arm. I couldn't say what I was feeling. But that time, at least, my father looked up. "Help me get those files in," his voice was hard and urgent. "We'll start tonight." And so I did. We unloaded the car, and we slapped together a few rough sandwiches. He prepared one of the sandwiches with more care and put it on a plate. I cut up an apple, arranged the slices around the bread, meat, and lettuce. When my mother didn't answer my tap on the bedroom door, I left it just outside. Holding our food in our hands, we went into my father's study and crammed our mouths as we frowned at the files. We brushed our crumbs to the floor. My father turned on the lamps. He settled himself at his desk and then nodded at me to do the same in the reading chair. "He's there," he said, nodding at the heavy stacks. I understood that I was going to help. My father was treating me as his assistant. He knew, of course, about my surreptitious reading. I glanced instinctively at the Cohen shelf. He nodded again, raised his eyebrows a fraction, and lip-pointed at the stack near my elbow. We began to read. And it was then that I began to understand who my father was, what he did every day, and what had been his life. Over the course of the next week, we culled several cases from the corpus of his work. During this time, which was the last week of school, my mother was unable to leave her room. My father brought her food. I sat with her in the evenings and read to her from the family album of favorite poems until she slept. It was an old maroon book with a ripped cover picturing happy white people reading poems in church to their children at bedtime, whispering into a sweetheart's ear. She would not let me read anything inspirational. I had to read the endless story poems with their ornate words and clunking rhythms, Ben Bolt, The Highwayman, The Leak in the Dyke, and so on. As soon as her breathing evened out, I slunk away, relieved. She slept and slept like she was sleeping for a sleeping marathon. She ate little, wept often, a grinding and monotonous weeping that she tried to muffle with pillows but which vibrated through the bedroom door. I'd go downstairs into the study with my father and continue reading through the files. We read with a concentrated intensity. My father had become convinced that somewhere within his bench briefs, memos, summaries, and decisions lay the identity of the man whose act had nearly severed my mother's spirit from her body. Chapter 3. Justice. August 16, 1987. Durland Peace, Plaintiff versus The Bingo Palace, Lyman Lamartine, Defendant. Darlin Peace is a janitor at the Bingo Palace and Casino and reports directly to Lyman Lamartine. He was fired on July 5, 1987, 2 days after an argument with his boss. A witness testified that the argument was overheard by several other employees and involved a woman dated by both men. On July 4, the employee cookout was held in the back courtyard patio of the Bingo Palace. During this cookout, Durland Peace, who had been repairing some equipment earlier that day, walked off the premises. He was stopped by Lyman Lamartine and asked to empty his pockets. In one pocket, 6 washers were found worth about 15 cents apiece. Lyman Lamartine then accused Durland Peace of attempting to steal company property and fired him. Durland Peace said that the washers belonged to him, as there were no distinguishing marks on the washers, which were examined by Judge Coutts. There was no proof that the washers belonged to the Bingo Palace, as there was no valid basis upon which Durland Peace could be fired. It was ordered that he be reinstated at the Bingo Palace. "Washers," I said. "What about them?" said my father. I looked back down at the file. Although this was not one of the cases we marked out as important, I remember it well. Here it was. The weighty matters on which my father spent his time and his life, I had, of course, been in court when he handled these sorts of cases. But I thought I was being excluded from weightier matters, upsetting or violent or too complex because of my age. I had imagined that my father decided great questions of law, that he worked on treaty rights, land restoration, that he looked murderers in the eye, that he frowned while witnesses stuttered and silenced clever lawyers with a slice of irony. I said nothing, but as I read on, I was flooded by a slow leak of dismay. For what had Felix S. Cohen written his handbook? Where was the greatness, the drama, the respect? All of the cases that my father judged were nearly as small, as ridiculous, as petty. Though a few were heartbreaking or a combination of sad and idiotic, like that of Marilyn Chagog, who stole 5 gas station hot dogs and ate them all in the gas station bathroom, none rose to the grandeur I had pictured. My father was punishing hot dog thieves and examining washers. Not even washing machines, just washers worth 15 cents apiece. December 8, 1976. Before Chief Judge Anton Coutts, also Justice Rose Chenois, and Associate Justice Mervyn Tubby Myagan. Tommy Thomas et al. Plaintiffs versus Vinland Supermart et al. Defendants. Tommy Thomas and the other plaintiffs in this case were Chippewa tribal members, and Vinland was and is a non-Indian-owned gas and grocery business, which, though located primarily on fee, former purchase allotment land, is surrounded by tribal trust land. The plaintiffs allege that during commercial transactions occurring at Vinland Supermart, a 20% surcharge was added to transactions involving tribal members showing signs of age-related dementia, innocence of extreme youth, mental preoccupation, inebriation, or general confusion. The owners, George and Grace Lark, did not deny that on some occasions a 20% surcharge had been added to cash register receipts. They defend their action by insisting it was a way to recoup losses from shoplifting. The defendants claim that the tribal court did not have personal jurisdiction over them or subject matter jurisdiction over the transactions, which were the basis for the plaintiff's complaint. The court found that although the gas station building itself was located on allotment number 122093, the parking lot, garbage dumpster, sidewalk, pumps, fire hydrants, sewage system, leach field, concrete parking barriers, outside picnic tables, and decorative flower planters were all located on tribal trust land, and that in order to enter the Vinland Supermart, customers, 86% of whom were tribal members, had to drive and then to walk across tribal trust land. This court claimed jurisdiction over the case, and as there was no evidence presented to deny the surcharge had taken place, found in favor of the plaintiffs. My father had kept this one aside. "It seems like an ordinary enough case," I said. I tried to keep the disappointment out of my voice. I was able, in that case, to claim limited jurisdiction over a non-Indian-owned business, said my father. The case held up on appeal. There was some pride in his voice. "That was satisfying," he went on, "but that is not the reason I've pulled the case. I marked it out to examine it further because of the people involved." I looked back at the file. Tommy Thomas et al. Or the Larks? The Larks. Though Grace and George are dead, Linda survives, and their son, Lyndon, who is not mentioned or involved here, but who figures in another action, one more emotionally complicated, the Larks are the sort of people who trot out their relationships with good Indians, whom they secretly despise and openly patronize, in order to prove their general love for Indians, whom they are engaged in cheating. The Larks were bumbling entrepreneurs and petty thieves, but they were also self-deceived. While their moral standards for the rest of the world were rigid, they were always able to find excuses for their own shortcomings. "It is these people really," said my father, "small-time hypocrites who may in special cases be capable of monstrous acts if given the chance." The Larks, in fact, were shrill opponents of abortion. Yet at the birth of their twins, they had been willing to put to death the weaker and, as they thought at the time, deformed member, a baby girl. The whole reservation knew about it because one of the nurses at the hospital removed the damaged twin. A tribal member, Betty Wishkop, who was a night janitor, succeeded in adopting the infant, which brings us to the other case. In the matter of the estate of Albert and Betty Wishkop. Albert and Betty Wishkop, both enrolled members of the Chippewa tribe and residents on the reservation, died intestate and with four children, Cheryl Wishkop Martin, Cedric Wishkop, Albert Wishkop Jr., and Linda Wishkop, who was born Linda Lark. Linda was informally adopted by the Wishkops and raised among their family as an Indian. At the death of her adoptive parents, the other children, who had moved off reservation, agreed to let Linda continue living as she had in the home of Albert and Betty, which is situated on allotment number 1002874, consists of 160 acres and was returned to tribal trust after the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. On January 19, 1986, the biological mother of Linda Lark Wishkob, Grace Lark, appealed to this court to allow her to assume guardianship of her now middle-aged daughter Linda, in order to manage her affairs. Grace Lark claimed that an illness contracted after Linda underwent a difficult medical procedure left Linda severely depressed and mentally confused. Grace Lark openly stated that she was interested in developing the 160 acres that she claimed had been left to Linda after her adoptive parents' death. The last paragraph was handwritten, an aside for my father's eyes only. "As Linda is non-Indian by blood, as there is no legal evidence that the Wishkobs formally adopted Linda, as Grace Lark made no attempt to contact the other three inheriting children involved, and as, moreover, Linda Lark Wishkob, in the opinion of the court, was not only mentally competent, but more sane than many who have come before this court, including her biological